In Conversation on Pride Radio.
I always say that you can judge somebody by their email signature. Now, I kind of have three businesses, and so my signature's quite busy and, you know, lots of logos on. On the footer of Carl's email signature, it says, Carlston OBE, DL. Greater Manchester LGBTQ Community Ambassador, Deputy Lieutenant of Greater Manchester, Ambassador of the George House Trust, the Proud Trust, Brofton House Veteran Care Village. He's the patron of Manchester Proud Chorus and Contact Manchester. He's the chair of Pro Manchester EDI Network. He's the chair of City of Trees Trust. He's the chair of City of Manchester IAJ GMP. He's the trustee Forever Manchester, and he's the ambassador for Fighting with Pride. To tell us all about that, please welcome Carl Austin Behan, OBE, DL. So, we know the OBE. DL, is it devilishly lovely? What does it stand for?
Deputy Lieutenant, but we'll go with devilishly lovely.
Devilishly lovely is gorgeous. Now, one thing that we always do to start it off, to see who the man is, I always do some quick-fire questions, and I never tell him what I'm going to ask him. And this kind of gets the jib of the man. So, beach holiday or culture vulture?
Beach holiday.
What's your karaoke go-to song?
The Lion Sleeps Tonight. A whim away, a whim away, a whim
away. Tight fit. Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
There you go. Oh, lovely. Last film you cried at?
Oh, Moana.
What, the cartoon?
Yeah. But I've got a 6.5-year-old daughter, so I end up watching a lot of Disney films. So, yeah, the last film, if we're talking about, yeah, Moana.
Was that because that's 2.5 hours of your life you'll never get back?
No,
is that what?
No, it's a beautiful film.
Also,
it's the music in it.
All right, there you go.
I only found it having a daughter. I never found it when it was actually a film that you'd see.
Not that you're gay or anything, just saying. Pineapple on a pizza?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love pineapple on a pizza. But the thing is, I've got a friend who runs a pizza restaurant, and he actually took my phone off me and deleted pictures when I took pictures of pineapple because he didn't want to be associated with pineapple on his pizzas.
See, normally it splits the room that people go, ooh, no.
Show of hands, who'd have pineapple on the pizza? That's a good show of hands.
There you are. Some people are too posh to have pizza, that's why they didn't raise their hand. Bearing in mind where we are, and we have marine snipers all around, favourite armed forces, Army, Navy or RAF?
On this occasion?
Yes, bearing in mind was on the front row.
I'm still going to have to say with Royal Air Force, and I do apologise, but loyalty.
Oh, fighting loyalty. Talk. Let's see if you can claw back here.
But it's such an amazing venue, and also because of the fact they do all the training for tri-services, I think that covers us all.
He wore his suit especially. Let's see if you can win back some of the audience now. What do you prefer? Gateshead or Newcastle?
Absolutely Gateshead.
Oh, Gateshead, there we are. We've got a result. So, we found out a few things about you, Carl, but tell me about, before we get on to the meaty things, we want to know about you as a kid, as a bairn. Tell me about growing up. What kind of decade are we talking and what was the time like?
Okay, so the time was, I was born in 1972. Very different era to where it is now, and I grew up in North Manchester, had two brothers. I was the baby of the family. And mum and dad was working for Dunlop. Mum worked as a secretary part-time. And, you know, it was just a case of just doing that sort of usual sort of growing up. I was a bit of a loner at school. But at the same time, it was very much a case of, like, I'd dip in and out of friends. So I've still got some of the friends that I actually knew back then, but it was a case of, I was very much a course of, I'd dip in and dip out, so I didn't have that sort of core element. I always felt I was different, and I remember having a conversation with my mum when I was around about 6 or 7, telling her that I felt that I was different, and I didn't have the same, I wasn't interested in football, and the fact that I ended up wanting to spend a lot of time with Boys Brigade, which is a youth organisation, same as Scouts. And I think, in a way, that sort of helped me shape me as a person, getting involved in a youth organisation, exactly the same as the cadets and the, you know, all them sort of things. And it was tough because it was very much a case of, like, North Manchester, quite a deprived area, but you just made the best of what you got. And
so a friend of Out North East is Joe McKeldry, the singer. And a recent concert, somebody held up a placard and they said, "Joe, marry me." And he went, "Oh, love, you're on the wrong bus with me." When did you think I might be on a different bus to everybody else?
From being about the age of 6 or 7. But I remember having the conversation. I can still remember having this particular conversation. We'd just come back. So it would have been 1977. We'd just come back from Pontins. And the reason why I remember it is because I fell in the boating lake. And also, it was the Silver Jubilee. And I remember doing this song, Jack and Jill, and winning this competition. But also having this conversation with my mum there, saying that I felt that there was something different about me. And so that would have been 5. But then, over the years, it was like, oh, it's a phase you're going through. It's a phase you're going through. That phase didn't really disappear. But even in secondary school, I ended up having encounters with lads at school. But I'd tell my mum what had happened, but it's just like, no, it's just a phase you're going through. And it was that thing about the fact that it was very different back then, you know, because no one would ever talk about being gay. I mean, my dad was a stereotypical sort of Alf Garnett type character. You know, he was racist, homophobic. To be fair, I just think he was uneducated. If we look at it in reality now, it's very much a case of like, that's just the way that they were.
But there weren't any positive role models on TV. We were the butt, literally, of all the jokes.
Yeah, but all you had on TV back then was your Larry Grayson. As we got a bit older, we had Julian Clary. You had, what's his name, out of Kenneth Williams.
Yeah.
You know, and it was all very much a case, it was all very camp innuendo. There was no normal gays growing up.
And as well, at the time, because I'm a year older than you, we had HIV/AIDS. We had a Thatcher government that brought in Section 28, which banned the promotion of homosexuality. So it was very much, get back in your closet, don't even open the door.
And I think that was the scary thing. So at the age of 14, 15, when I actually thought that I may be gay, and that I felt there was something about me that was different. It was when we were having the tombstones, when we were having HIV thrown at us, telling us we're going to die of this gay disease. I didn't want to die. I remember having conversations as a kid, always saying that I wanted to get married and have children. And I think one of the reasons why my mum was so upset about me possibly being gay was I think she was hurting inside the fact that I was going to grow up very lonely. I was going to grow up as, you know, never having children, never being able to get married, never being able to sort of, who's going to look after you in your older years type thing. And I think that was one of the reasons why I think that she was so worked up about me being who I was and possibly being gay. But as I say, HIV and AIDS, you know, we all remember the tombstone at a certain age, remember the tombstone adverts. And it wasn't local information, this. This was like, this was worldwide that was going out. It was, you know, it was from all angles. It was the media, it was the politicians. Everyone was like, HIV is a gay disease. If you're gay, you're gonna die of it. No one spoke about lesbians. No one spoke about it. It was just a gay man's disease. And that you having sex with a man, you're gonna catch this disease and you're gonna be dead. And the thing is, there was no investment. There was no support. There was no financial that was put behind it. If we look at COVID, what's just happened now, or recently, if they'd spent a zinth of the money that they'd spent on trying to eradicate COVID, they could have eradicated HIV and AIDS 35 years ago. 40 years, we're still trying to get people to understand that we need to break down the stigma of HIV and AIDS.
So this Alf Garnett upbringing, no positive representation, is that why you thought, you know, you've talked to me before that you wanted to be normal, you wanted to marry and have kids, etc. Is that why the armed forces called to you? Did you think it's the masculine thing to do? I must go into this.
It was strange. So I ended up going into the air. So I'd always wanted to be a fireman from an early age. but Greater Manchester weren't recruiting. My brother was over in Akrotiri and I was 17 and a half. I went to visit him and I realised he had a fire service. And I thought that that was a way of running away. I thought, if I join the Air Force, random, if I join the Air Force, I'll have this temptation taken away from me. The temptation of all these young men, you know, in uniform. bit random. But just thought about that. But no, I thought that the Air Force would take away that craving or that element of me that would save me from catching HIV and AIDS and save me from living a life that I didn't want to be gay. I really didn't want to be gay because being gay isn't, back then, it was just all hatred thrown at you. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like what the trans community have got right now. You know, people are coming at you at every angle. People are really sort of fighting for you. And I didn't want that. So for me, joining the Air Force, however, even from the day that I joined the Air Force, I ended up living a double, sometimes treble life because of that.
Because obviously you knew that, take us to that day that you enrolled.
Yep, 2nd of April. Sorry, 2nd of
April. It's illegal for what you're doing.
I've still got the paperwork. I remember going to the Careers Information Office and they gave me this piece of paper to sign. And they were, oh, you're not gay, are you? Just sign that. And they laughed at me. So I just signed it. And on that piece of paper, it does say that if you're involved in homosexual activity, you will be court-martialed, you will be dismissed. You know, and I've still got that piece of paper. But the reason why I wanted to join and to do what I did, even though I thought that I may be gay, I didn't want being gay to define me. I didn't think that my sexuality had anything to hold me back. And that was what, in 1991?
So you joined up. Were you aware of other gay people around you in the forces at the time? Or was it... I mean, this was a time before the internet and mobile phones, etc. Did you know of anyone, or was it just...
No.
Just alien? It was a different world?
It was a complete different world. So when I would go... So in the Air Force, it was completely alien. It wasn't... You'd be there, and I'd have these feelings, I'd have these sort of things about people, but you just knew you could... It was untouchable because everyone was straight. You know, it was taken that everyone was in that sort of world. And that's why I say about the fact of having to live a double, treble life at times, because I'd go in there, I'd go to camp, I'd spend a week, 2 weeks, and be there, I'd be going out with the lads, going clubbing, ending up going to a nightclub, getting off with girls, just to hide the fact of who I was, because then of a weekend or on my days off, I'd come back to Manchester, get to Piccadilly Station, and be met by 9 o'clock on a Friday night. I'd then disappear till 11 o'clock the next day, turn up at home, make out that I'd just got home then. Very scary because, you know, this was a time way before dating apps, way before we had mobile phones, way before we had connectivity. So it was a case of having to do that for the whole time that I was in. And it's only as you get older that you realise that actually that was quite a scary place you were putting yourself into just to be who you are. And I'd go to places like, I'd go to Birmingham, I'd go to London, I'd go out, I'd go to some bars and stuff, always in the back of my mind that I had to be really careful because the MOD and the armed forces would send people looking for people who may be gay within the armed forces going out clubbing to get them arrested and to beat them up, rape them, do whatever they would do to them. So I'd go out and it'd be a case of, oh, my name was Ashley or Nathan. I don't know why I chose those two names, but it was always Ashley or Nathan. I think they're quite cute names. You'd literally live in that double life. Now, when I was at Chivner in North Devon, in the Air Force, there was this girl I'd started seeing to cover up the fact there'd been rumours that I may be gay. So I started seeing this girl, Nikki, and she was actually engaged to someone at the time. This makes me sound really bad.
You're a heartbreaker here.
And then I started seeing her. She then fell pregnant. We got engaged on my 21st birthday, and unfortunately she had a miscarriage a few weeks later, so I broke it up. But it was I was using her to hide who I was. I mean, we've met and we had conversations since then and stuff like that, and we're, you know, absolutely fine. Her sister's a lesbian. And at the same time, there'd been an aircraft crash at Chivna as well. A Hawk aircraft, same as the Red Arrows. It crashed on the runway. I was one of the first people to turn up on the appliance that I was on, knocked down the main flame mast, got on top of the fuselage. It was still on fire. There was things ricocheting off it, got a crack against the helmet, but I managed to get the pilot out. Unfortunately, he died 11 days later, but with that, I got the British Humane Society Bronze Award for Bravery, a Good Show Award from the Air Force. So there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on at that time.
So obviously awarded, and the thing that you leave out, that ejector seat could have gone any time with you on it, so you could have lost your life for doing what you did. Did you suddenly feel a bit invincible?
No, I didn't feel
invincible. Was there a bit that, I've got this award now, I can be a little bit more gayer, a little bit more open, because they won't touch me, because...
No, it was the opposite, actually.
Really?
Yeah, because... No one likes people when they succeed in something. And the people that I was with on the camp, they resented me a little bit. Wow. The other firefighters, everyone else was fine about it. But the other crew and the rest of the people, because the crew was a team of seven, but I can honestly say, hand on heart, there was only probably two of us that actually did anything. And I'm not just saying that to sort of egg it up, but it's like a case of, it was that thing where they were like, well, why have you, you know, you've got that, but I was the one that was sat on top of a live ejection seat, which could have gone, you know, to make that safe, it took them 2 weeks, and they had to cordon off 400 metres, because of the fact it could have blown at any time, and I'm sat on top of it, because of what had happened was, the first pilot had ejected, it had come off, second one tried to eject, but it ejected as it had the impact, which actually knocked the ejection seat runner off the runner cord, so it could have gone at any time. But yeah, and I think that was the reason why, if I'm honest, I was posted to Belize pretty quickly after that, as a way of like, look, let's just get him out of that situation, because it did turn into, even though I love the Air Force and I loved everything about it, that was an uncomfortable time for me, because you were put on this bit of a pedestal, but actually people wanted to pull you down from it, for all the wrong reasons.
And we've got pictures of you here serving. So is this you getting your awards in different places? Talk us through these pictures
right,
at the
so
top.
That, so, as I say...
They're very sepia. It looks like it's 1945 on this, you know. Did you not have colour back then, love?
I need to update these pictures. So, as I say, because the fact of getting the British Humane Society Award, it was quite quickly afterwards. So I actually received the award in Belize rather than at Chivna. So this was the station commander that was based at in Belize to give me my award. The one in the middle is, so in 1996, I received the Queen's Award for Commander-in-Chief's Commendation for other stuff that I did within the Air Force. So that's what that picture was for. And that was just one that I thought I looked quite cute.
Yeah.
If I'm honest.
That would be on a Grindr profile nowadays, wouldn't it?
That was at RAF Henlow in 93, and I just thought, I like the way I look on this
Okay,
picture.
So we'll put Vane down on the list of things. But up to the point that we're going to get to, which is the point where people ask you the question, what was your career route? You know, were you... Was this life? This was going to be it for the next 30 years, and you were going to become commander or whatever.
I loved and still love the Air Force. I, in a very short time, I was only in for 6 years, but I did my basic training, did my trade training. I went to RAF Chivna, then went to Belize, then went to Henlow in Bedfordshire, then went to Ascension, did two very short tours of Cyprus, and also managed to go to Honington and do Ascension Island. Most people, they'd only do one tour. So I was very much about the fact of I wanted to achieve what I could. Excuse me. And I created work for myself. I was doing a lot of secondary duties. When I was in Ascension Island, when you're in Ascension Island as a firefighter, it should be a dream job. You're only there for two aircraft, one coming in, one going out each week. But I created it as a day job because I wanted to go and do fire training. I wanted to go do fire safety. I went and did educational, the schools and the hospital. And that's why I ended up getting the Queen's mention in 1996. I'd sort of orchestrated it in a way that I loved it so much that I'd already started the idea that I was going to get my commission to go as an officer, but also I'd signed on initially for 9 years. I'd now signed on for 12 years, but as soon as my promotion came through, which it did in the January of 1997, I'd then already put forward to sign up for 22 years. So yeah, in my head, there was times where I wanted to leave because I felt like I couldn't be my true authentic self, but I know that the Air Force wanted me because that's why they gave me a promotion. That's why they want, you know, I loved it. I had exemplary service. I had 3 nines and spec rep for 3 years on a row, which was unheard of. As I say, getting promoted in 6 years was unheard of. So yeah, the Air Force, and that goes back to my apology to yourself for in your house, the fact that the Air Force means so much to me.
They have planes and boats now, you're fine. So, you're a grafter. You are exemplary in what you do. You're awarded. You're still having these issues that, you know, you're having to live this double life. Take us to that moment when somebody senior confronted you, that fateful day. Did you know it was coming? Had you had an inkling that you'd been spotted in a gay bar?
No, it didn't happen like that. So what happened was I mentioned my dad earlier. I ended up telling my dad in the November of 96 that I was gay. And it was the first time that my dad gave me a hug, gave me a kiss, said, look, son, no one ever told me how to live my life. I'm not going to tell you how to live yours. Which really threw me, but it also threw my mum. What happened then was it gave me the confidence, probably a bit too much confidence, because I then started going out in Manchester, started going out more on the gay scene. I was a bit like a kid in a sweet shop, but also still living, pretending to be somebody else, but then I'd let my guard down quite a few times. I started seeing this lad who works in Cruise 101 in a nightclub in Manchester. Started seeing him, and I told him that I was getting promoted, and then I told him that I was going overseas. He then contacted the Air Force to say that I was gay. And I'm not sure, I've never worked out whether or not it was because he wanted me to stay there or just not go overseas, or just to sort of mess me up, because he ended up getting back with his ex-boyfriend anyway. So I never really understood that bit, but I knew, I remember getting there on the morning, it was just after Easter in April 1997, and I got a call to say I needed to go to OC Personal Services flight in full uniform. So I got my full uniform on. And when I got there, there was two RAF police, the officer of the command. There was also the padre, who's a vicar. And they just sat me down and said, SEC Austin, do you have homosexual tendencies? And I froze, and then he asked me again, and I just burst into tears. And I think, obviously, that answered the question for them. They then asked again, and I responded that, yes, why are you asking? And they said that, right, just so you know, now you've admitted this allegation, you're incompatible to service life. You could go to military prison for 6 months. Your services are no longer required. However, because of your exemplary service, we don't think it's appropriate that you know with going to prison. And there was so much to take in that split second that I now lost everything. In that split moment, I lost my job, my career, I lost my house because I lived on camp. I lost all my friends because I wasn't able to say goodbye to anybody. I was told I couldn't wear the medal that I'd received because it was given in military service. I was supposed to go to a garden party at Buckingham Palace for the work that I'd done for the charities. I was told I couldn't do that. And everything just ended just like that, just because of my sexuality in 1997. And it's weird because I was then taken away, as I say, not being able to say goodbye to anyone. We didn't have mobile phones, so I didn't have anyone's numbers. I had to go to the room. I was given three big boxes, but then I was escorted off camp. And I just remember going into this little lay-by. I had a little courser at the time, just parked in this little lay-by, and just sat there for 3 hours crying, wondering what am I supposed to do now? Because I'm now homeless, jobless. I've got nothing to support me. Yet, an hour previous, life was rosy.
And it's that amazing cut-off. There's no severance pay, there's nothing like that. You are literally three boxes and you're through the door. So a lot of people would probably say, well, you'd spent 6 years not telling the truth. Could you have turned around? Did you ever think in the car, I should have just said, no, I'm not gay, don't be silly. Could you have gone through it? Or were you at that point in your mind that you just had to say it?
I was at that point because I think because of the fact that people accepted who I was and didn't have a problem with it. And I was now going out being me. The fact that the job that I was doing had no impact on my sexuality. And I just think that, I know that if I think 99.9%, if I'd have said no to that question when they'd asked me, I think that it'd have been a case of, thank you very much, just someone's made an allegation, we just needed to ask you, crack on, get on with it.
Yeah.
But there comes a point at the age of what, I was 25 then, and I think it was like, whose life am I living? And it was about me being me, and also the fact that how long do I carry on using girls, using other people, not being my true authentic self, but also having to keep living this lie and the pressure. I remember, one of the things that I will say is I remember when my dad accepted it, mum accepted it, and you know, I told my brother actually, and my brother was in the Air Force, and he told me that whatever happens, no one's to know that he knew. So me and my brother fell out for many years. But I remember.
But why was that? Was
because
there could be repercussions.
Because, yeah, because repercussions on him as
well. It wasn't just the person. It could have hit family members serving.
He could have been kicked out as well.
For not telling.
Yeah.
You know, dubbing you in.
That's it, yeah.
Wow.
And who remembers pressure cookers?
Yeah.
It was like, you know, this little thing. I know it sounds a really weird thing, but I remember just feeling that it was so much pressure, so much pressure, so much pressure. But actually, even though everything that happened on that day in April when I had to admit who I was, I felt like that pressure cooker was releasing because it's now out there. It's now.
And that's what we always say, you know, it's if it's safe to do so, always come out just for yourself. You'll find out then who your family and your true friends are. But you've got to be yourself, haven't you? And you lost the profession, the career that you loved because you were more important, and rightly so. So you leave there, but you go back into service, don't you? You join the fire brigade.
Yeah, so I ended up, during the time that I was off, I ended up going to work for Asda for a bit, shelf stacking. But then I applied to Great Manchester Fire and Rescue Service. And I made a point of not telling them why I was leaving the Air Force because it seemed like a natural progression to go into the fire service. So I managed to do the aptitude test, do everything I had to do the fitness, got in, got my contract. And then the day I started, I mentioned the fact, oh, by the way, and this was to the officers, just mentioned to them that, by the way, the reason why I've joined is because I was kicked out of the Air Force for being gay. And they were like, no, we don't have gays in the fire service. I was like, well, you do, because I know you've got some. Yeah, none of them are out. No one's out. And I was then told that I wasn't allowed to tell the recruits and disclose my sexuality because it was a residential and it might have an impact on their lives, or on their career, sorry. Anyway, it lasted for about 3 weeks, and in the end, it was that thing about, because it was residential, I spent all the time with them, but I wasn't able to talk about things that I'd done at the weekend, or I wasn't able to talk about anything else. So I ended up telling the lads were fine about it. It was the officers in the hierarchy that had an issue with it, very much on the case of like, you shouldn't be sort of flaunting your sexuality. And I was like, I'm not flaunting it, I'm doing nothing different. I'm just telling you that this is why I got kicked out of the Air Force, and I'm not going to hide away. We're not going to go from one institution to another institution. They then decided to, because they didn't have any diversity, equality, or inclusion officers at the time, they then pulled this couple together who were married, who happened to know someone who was gay. Don't even know if they liked the gay person. They just happened to know someone who was gay. They went round to the different fire stations that I'd be associated with to say, this is how you talk to a gay, this is how you act around a gay. if the gay upsets you or the gay has any impact on your life, you let us know and we'll deal with the situation. So it's very much a case of like, I was the problem to it. And this was the fire service in 1998. And what's, you know, I stayed in for 18 months and I hated it. I hated every minute of it because I joined for the wrong reasons. And I remember when I was leaving, I turned around to one of the guys and said, look, I'm leaving, I've had enough of this. He said, no, don't leave. What you do is you go off on the sick. After 3 months, they'll call you in. Don't come in, they'll then come to your house. And then what you do is you just turn around and say, someone made a homophobic comment about you, and that they'll give you a big payoff. You'll still get a good pension because they won't want to be associated with the bad press and negativity. I thought, I don't want to live my life like that. That's not what I'm about. I'm quite happy to leave. But like, yeah, but it's a career for 30 years. Jesus. Yeah. 30 years living a lie. No.
So you leave and like, you know, you've spent your life hiding who you are. Some people would be broken and they would disappear. But this guy comes along. The naked guy with the winner sash, and you go off to become Mr. Gay UK. There's no hiding behind that love, is there? You know, was that a deliberate thing to say, two fingers to your wall, this is who I am, I've had to hide it for so long, and I still look cute in a sash, or?
No, at first it was very much a case of like, yeah, I wanted to do it because I thought it was a bit of fun. And because in 99, 2000, I won Mr. Gay Manchester. It was a joint year that year. And overall, I came second. But it made me realise during that year that we didn't have any normal gays who's role models. I mean, I know we touched on role models before. And I'm not saying I was a role model. But what?
Or normal.
but the fact that I wanted to normalise being gay. Because all you saw was camp or butch with lesbians, and they're very much like, you know, stereotypical muscle Marys that you'd see. But, you know, I'd been in the Air Force, been in the fire service, stacked shelves, I'd worked on shop floors and stuff like that. And I just thought, no, this is where we need to sort of break it down. So in 2001, I stood again, won Mr. Gay Manchester, and then I treated it a little bit like a political campaign and a bit like an election campaign by going around to different Pride events and saying, oh, what do you want out of the gay community? And that's where I got involved with a lot of the charities like LGBT Foundation, different Pride events, Proud Trust. And it was about the fact of being a representative for the community. And, you know, I've known you a long time, and I came to Pride back in the day when it was just on the park before it got bigger. But actually speaking to people and to actually have that engagement, because, you know, if we look at Coronation Street, you know, we've got your Sean Tully, Anthony Cotton, you know, he's there, they've got the campus guy with a vicar, why can't we just have normal gays who just happen to live in a house who happen to be gay? You know, oh, there's no story there. Well, there is, because you look at the other aspects that can become of that relationship. So that was it. I wanted to normalise being gay. And I think once I won that in Manchester in 2001, it gave me a bit of a platform to have those conversations and to work on that. And I'm still very proud of what Mr. Gay UK was about and about what it can do for the community. The fact of having someone independently having a voice, as opposed to you're part of a charity, you're part of an organisation, whereas having someone individual who actually can speak it on behalf of the community in a positive way, and rather than it just be about a pride event going out for the weekend, you know, it's about the positives rather than the negatives.
So in the room, we have the new Mr. Gay Great Britain, Ben Lloyd. You know him because he's wearing a sash. Gays just don't normally come out and wear a glitter sash. He's been in post for like 5 days from Gateshead. So Gateshead Council, do that post and watch the reformers bite at it. That'll be lovely. Your 30 second, what would you say to expect and what to do?
Get involved with the community. Make sure it's not about you. It's about them. It's about the charities, about the organisations, making sure that whatever voice you've got is positive, and also making sure that it's very much about the whole community. Let's remember that we wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for the whole community. And that I'm talking about the trans community, non-binary, I'm talking about lesbians, I'm talking about everybody. Because I think sometimes people get in their head that, oh, I'm inventing this, or I've made this happen. Well, you've got to remember that there's been people around for many, many years, and you wouldn't be where you are without those people. And the fact that the community can be quite bitchy at times, as I'm sure you're aware.
Really?
Right?
Really?
But you have to brush that aside. You have to really do brush it aside, but also just make sure that you're supporting everybody within that community, because the thing is, if you're not, and I know it's Mr. Gay, but also it's the fact of, let's be honest, you're representing the LGBTQ plus community across the country, not just the area you're representing as well.
And remember the allies. We need the allies. So, you used it as a political platform. You then go on... Yeah, see? I do my research sometimes. You go on then to become a councillor in Manchester. And then, lo and behold, you are the first openly gay Lord Mayor of Manchester in a pink frock with the husband mincing down the road with the gayest dogs ever and balloons.
They'd been groomed there, hadn't they, at that time? That's the dogs.
So, you know, again, almost...
I like firsts.
Yeah, I was going to say, were the pink robes already there?
No.
Or, Madam Mayor, you're here, are you going to take tips? Are we going to go back for the pink?
So what happened was, I got involved in local politics in 2005 by moaning about dog dirt, people parking in cycle lanes, bins overflowing, the state of the canal, you know, the little things that wind you up on a day-to-day basis but actually over time, they become big things. I've always been involved in the Labour Party as a kid, but I then got involved in the local party. And then someone sowed a seed to become a councillor. So in 2011, I got elected for Burnage, South Manchester. And I wanted that because it was very similar to the area. It was very similar to where I lived in Crumsall. Excuse me. And when I was on there, it's like, I think Manchester, especially in the late 80s, early 90s, led the way when it came to LGBT equality. Mm-hmm. Especially if we look at the Section 28 march, where we had 20,000 people fighting for Section 28 when all that came in 1988. But I felt that Manchester had sort of taken a bit of a back step and just thought, it's fine now, we've done that. But I realised the fact that there was a lot more to do, and we were falling down the rankings, we're falling down the ratings in the country. So I then became lead member for Gay Men. And I remember just being in a room in 2013, looking at this picture, and on this wall in the town hall, they had all the pictures of the former Lord Mayors. And I think there was one person of colour, there was one female. And yet they were all of around about 70 years of age. They all looked a bit like the Fat Controller out of Thomas the Tank Engine.
Not like Gateshead's, they're young and vibrant.
Yeah, and I just felt, if this is a city that's supposed to represent our community, then let's do this. So I put myself forward, and in 2014-15, I got 41 votes. But then the following year, I got the winner got 42. So I used it as a campaign then, and I managed to get selected and elected as the first openly gay Lord Mayor in 2016. I was also the youngest, and I remember that the council didn't want to say first openly gay Lord Mayor, but because they were worried that someone might turn around and say, "Oh, if he's the first openly gay, there must have been a gay one before," yeah. Which in 120 years history, I'm sure there has been. Yeah. But no, I wanted to do that, and I had a. I did an article for Manchester Evening News, and Jen Williams, who was a journalist, she did this brilliant article, and I was completely open and transparent about everything. And the reason why was because if I'd not been open and transparent about everything, when it talks about going out clubbing, when it talks about Mr. Gay UK, when it talks about the nightlife or the things I've done in the past, I felt that the Mail on Sunday would turn around, new Lord Mayor of Manchester, gay porn, shock, horror. There is no porn out there, by the way, but they would have, not that I'm aware of, but they could have quite easily have turned that picture and pictures in a calendar into being porn. So I thought, no, do it that way. And you know what? It was a brilliant year. And normally Lord Mayor would do around about 350 engagements. We did, and thanks to Simon, my husband, because I couldn't have done it without him. We did 1,126 engagements with the community. And I thought that we won't get to schools, we won't get to temples, we won't get to mosques, we thought there was a group of people, organisations that we won't get into. However, they invited us because it gave them the opportunity for them not to have to have that conversation, whereas we could have that conversation.
And that's the thing. I mean, I love the fact that the mayor just breathed out and went, "Oof, that's a lot."
You said you were busy.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we have to ask, because obviously, as the mayor, do we have Lady Mayor? Was there a big hoo-ha about what do we call Simon?
Well, was he... so...
Go on.
When we were discussing it, at very first it was like, "Oh, you need to have a consort." I was like, a consort? Because 9 times out of 10 he's going to get called an escort, which he did on a few occasions. But then Simon, for the first time in the history of the thing, wore the Lady Mayoress chains, which did cause a bit of controversy. But because this was it was like new territory to the office as well, and to the council, it's like, okay, we'll just let that happen. So obviously the chain of office, but then Simon wore the Lady Mayoress chains. And the robes, what happened there was, for Manchester Pride, so I was leading, I'd asked to lead as Grand Marshal. I'd done some promotion work back in the day, and a company that did some mascots and stuff like that said they could do as the robes for us. It cost £500. Now, initially the council said they'd pay for them, but then Freedom of Information came along. Someone wants to know why the money's being spent on pink robes. So I bought the robes myself. Then we gave them to a charity. Then the charity, someone bought them for £5,000 at this charity, and then gave them back to me. And I'm going to give them to the People's History Museum, because it's just, I can't do anything with them in a loft. But what I think is really significant about this is 2001, 2016, as the first citizen of Manchester, in 15 years, what we'd achieved through equal marriage, equal partnership, within rights of having children, adoption rights, we'd achieved so much in such a short time. And I'm really proud that in 2001, I was walking that same parade route that I'm going to do on Saturday, because it's Manchester Pride this week, same route, in a pair of hot pants and a sash, to then become the first citizen of Manchester. I think that shows progress within our community, and I'm really pleased about that.
Also shows age. You don't want to be in the hot pants 15 years later, love.
However, the Botox is working.
Still look great. So how did then, obviously, campaigning, and still with that military background in your head, How did Fighting With Pride come along? Because you were one of the trustees that set up Fighting With Pride.
Yeah, so I was very lucky. So in 2020, I was invited to Westminster. Johnny Mercer was doing an apology on behalf of... Johnny Mercer was doing an apology on behalf of the government to apologise. I'm like, it's 20 years late, but never mind. But then I was in a room. There was roughly 50 people from the Air Force, 50 people from the Navy, 50 people from the Army all there, all saying how amazing the armed forces were. And they are, and they were. And you know, and I won't take that away from them. But none of them knew the history. None of them knew what people had gone through to get where they are today. Now, it was a lovely event, but at the same time, I met a guy called Craig Jones, and I met Caroline Page. I've known Caroline for many years. In fact, Caroline was based at RAF Chivna when the aircraft crash happened. So our paths had crossed previously, but that was before Caroline had transitioned. So then the charity, Craig had wrote this book, and he'd got some inserts from different people, and he put it together, an editorial. And I think we could all feel the tension. And he'd already started the conversations to set up a charity. But it was very London-focused, the group of people, and they were all more officer-focused. And I think a conversation, I think they could see my passion, my desire, my anger about what had happened between 1967 and 2000. And it had to be, and the reason why I say 96, so the reason why it's 1967 is that's because when homosexuality was partially decriminalised, and I'm going to mention something else in a minute on that, but that was something that there was a time period. So it's about setting up a charity to look at the injustice that was done. And I was, thankfully, they asked me if I'd get involved, and I did. And it had so much traction quite quickly. And I think because the way that the government was trying to get things sorted out, you know, within that time, we had Lord Etherton, was commissioned to do a review for the LGBT independent review. Rishi Sunak did an apology on his recommendation. We've got a lot of work, and I know that Peter will mention more shortly on Fighting With Pride. But that's how Fighting With Pride started. And it's like, I remember in November 2021 being asked if I'd like to march at the Cenotaph in London, which it was such an emotional moment, because in 2020 I'd been awarded an OBE for my services to charity, and I'd received it on the Tuesday from Prince William. Now, I'd met Prince William before when I was Lord Mayor, but what was interesting, the Queen was supposed to do the salute. But I'd had a conversation with William about the fact that we were going to be on the parade, we were doing this, and he was from 22 Squadron, so we'd had that connection anyway. Anyway, when we did the march past, I eyeballed him when he was doing the salute, and we got a wink and we got a smile. And it was something so personal and so emotional that we could all see and we could all grasp. And I just think that was it. You know, it was one of the moments that you're never going to get back. But the work that Fighting With Pride has done over the years has been spectacular in the fact that how quickly they've managed to get things done. And yes, there is financial reward, but what I will say is 3 years ago, nothing was on the table. So the amount of work that Fighting With Pride has done over the 5 years is testament to a very young, new charity, but also the expectations are very high. But we have to be honest about the fact of, you know, as I say, nothing was on the table. The only reason why I wanted to touch on there was, so in 1967, when homosexuality was decriminalised, being a lesbian has never been illegal, ever. However, because of that ruling, the armed forces put that as a rule. So for lesbians, it affected lesbians within the armed forces from 1967 to 2000. And that's important when it comes to the stuff that Fight Me Pride is doing, because the fact that the amount of women who were affected during the ban is a lot higher than it is for men, because they were an easy target.
13-year-old you, We've kind of touched on it. You want it to be normal. You want it to be married. You want it to have a kid. You want it to be true to yourself. Now the 50-odd-year-old you is married, does have a kid, and is true to yourself. What would you say to that 13-year-old?
Just believe in your dreams. You can do it. You know, I left school with one GCSE in drama, but I don't think that necessarily it's about the individual. Just follow your dreams. Just go for what you want to do. Don't let anyone say no to you. You're going to have enough people saying no to you. But believe in yourself and just be yourself. Be your true, authentic self. And you're going to be okay. Life's going to be okay.
You sent me a lovely message. When we did this event in South Tyneside, a member of the pub audience came up to you and you sent it. And forgive me, I didn't do Latin. But he said, a guy came up to you and said, the Royal Air Force motto is per adieu ad astra, which translates to through adversity to the stars. And you said he thought that related to my life, which I thought was a beautiful thing to say. Well, it's been beautiful listening about your life. Ladies and gentlemen, Carl. Now,
can I say a massive, just one last thing I just want to say, a massive thank you to yourself.
I just want to say this to
yourselves and the team that you've got around you and out North East and the work that you're doing and the volunteers and the support group. I just want to say thank you to you, and also I've seen everything you're doing for all the Summer of Pride and the stuff that the amount of work that you've put into it in an area that needs a lot of support for the LGBT community. I just want to thank you for trusting in me to come and do these talks, but also for everything that you've done and the community, and also the volunteers and the people around you that have supported you in what you believe in.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
In Conversation on Pride Radio.